I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
angling for a fight after a raucous protest that prevented the reading of the provincial budget today, a fisherman in Newfoundland and Labrador tells us he believes in demonstrating peacefully, but also says that doesn't mean he'll go quietly.
In his export opinion, a researcher explains what he's managed to learn about Canada's military exports and tells us how that squares with what Ottawa is actually saying about what it is and is not sending to Israel.
Ticket to nowhere. Ismail Karsholi died in Gaza waiting for an emergency visa. We reach his family in Toronto who tell us they're terrified his daughter could meet the same fate.
Putting their best flutes forward, donations are pouring into a workshop that fixes instruments for school kids in L.A. after a documentary about the repair shop won an Oscar.
There's no such thing as a free lunch. After helping fund a rocketry project at Concordia University, a Montreal pizzeria gets an unexpected perk, the chance to send a slice to space.
And he had another thing succumbing. In a primary election, an Ohio Republican concedes, unconcedes, and reconcedes in a series of communication failures that include a reference to its being such an impotent night. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that guesses he had trouble maintaining an election. A rowdy protest by fishermen has disrupted government business in Newfoundland and Labrador and has the premier warning of mass arrests. This morning, hundreds of fishermen blocked entrances to the provincial legislature. Here's the sound of one protester yelling in the face of Premier Andrew Furey's Director of Communications, Megan McCabe, and preventing her from getting into the building.
Oh yeah, so do I! So do I! I got kids, I got everything else! Go f*** yourself!
The fishermen are angry about regulations limiting where they can sell their catch. Currently, they can only sell to buyers inside the province at prices set by their union and the Association of Seafood Producers. John Effort is a fisherman who was at the protest. We reached him in St. John's.
John, are you comfortable with what went down at the protest? Exchanges like the ones we heard there, in one case, yelling in the face of a woman who was trying to get to work. Are you comfortable with what went down?
No, I'm not comfortable with that at all. But the person in question was a person who directly worked for the government's office and came out and incited our members, knowing that tensions were high.
How did they incite? How did she incite your members?
Basically, the person who started that was the other party, and incited one of our members or a couple of our members with nasty comments, which in a situation like this, when frustrations are at a high, they knew exactly what they were doing to give some bad press to our cause.
In the video, it doesn't appear to be any aggression on her part. She seemed like she was trying to get in the building, but you think it was off camera?
Let me correct you. There was no physical aggression. When we say aggression, there was no physical aggression. Not that I'm correcting you. I want to make that clear.
Sure.
There was no physical aggression. It was words.
This was, of course, supposed to be budget day, and as much clearly tension and anger and request for change, demand for change that there is from you and your colleagues, the government still has work to do on behalf of you and others there. So what do you think you gain by blockading entrances like this and having exchanges like that?
Again, the exchanges, that was an anomaly, and it was caused by, not by our members. And again, I'll go back again and say, when you incite somebody who's very frustrated with a situation, it's a lot harder to show restraint when somebody is actually inciting you. So we'll leave that alone right now. And the question to what's it doing for our cause? Listen, we've been lobbying, protesting for the last 3 weeks, and we're getting nowhere. Our numbers are growing. People are coming to the realization what's happening with our fishery, where our fishery is going, where our own personal businesses are going as independent owner operators, and where rural Newfoundland is going to end up if we don't get some change now. So our business is not going to run. I'm sorry, but we got to get something done with this right now.
So if it means, you know, blocking the building, delaying the budget, regardless of what trouble that might cause, the ripple effect, you're okay with that?
Blocking the building and the budget being delayed. It's didn't condone that when we got there this morning. Mm-hmm. It was all told to all participants. You know, this is a peaceful protest. We're not here to cause anybody harm, anybody damage.
Let's talk about the regulations that there's so much anger about that dictate who fishermen in the province can sell their catch to. Was that initially created to protect jobs at local fish plants? Wasn't that the goal initially?
Yes, no doubt. Initially, it was created to keep the product local in Newfoundland. But look, as time progresses, that's an outdated policy there now. And what has happened with that policy? Yes, I agree that look, we should keep as much product here in Newfoundland to create work here in Newfoundland. No doubt. But now when you have a group of companies who are colluding together to use that policy to control the fish harvesters and control every aspect of the fish harvest, well, okay, we gotta take another look at it. We got to get that policy changed.
Just in terms of a personal example, what does this situation mean for your livelihood?
Look, the way it's going, look, we took a lesson from last year. We've seen companies with one of the all-time high profit records when the fish harvesters were selling them the fish broke even or were on the other side of even. There's a problem. So we got to fix it. And again, I'm going to reiterate, everyone is thinking this is about price and think that this is about nothing else other than greed. This is not greed. This is just trying to take care of our own business that we can basically have free enterprise. That's been our mantra ever from the beginning. It's free enterprise, and that's all we're looking for, and we want it in all species. We're looking for competition and a fair market. We're the only province in Canada that has these rules. We want them changed. If you want to open a fish plant in Nova Scotia, you put the facility in, you find the finances yourself, you put the facility in, you go through the regular health safety checks and food inspection, whatever. You're issued your license here in Newfoundland. If you want to go get a fish processing license, you contact the government. They say no.
Newfoundland's fisheries minister says he is willing to meet some of your demands, specifically for the crab fishery. Are you worried at all that what happened today might put a wrench in that and that the government might now be unwilling to negotiate with you?
That'd be pretty unfair. Basically, if they're willing to do something one day and not the next, so that's... That would be pretty vindictive, wouldn't it?
Do you think, though, that you might have to change your strategy or talk to the people on the front line?
Look, we've tried to do this. I guess you'd say, for lack of better words, the right way, through meetings, through talking. I mean, this has first been brought to the attention of the government last year. Started sometime last year. Every fisherman on the island told them the same thing. We need more capacity. We need competition. We need outside buyers. We have to fix this. Every fisherman in Newfoundland is telling the same thing.
John, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. You have a good day.
You too. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
We reached John Effort in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador. Ishmael Karasholi died waiting for help that never came. He was stuck in Gaza with his daughter. His family had applied for an emergency visa to get him to safety in Canada. But his family says the government's new visa program for Gazans is too complicated and requires them to leave the Strip to complete their applications, which is nearly impossible. The government says more than 10,000 applications have been accepted, but so far only 14 people have been able to cross into Egypt. Marcus Karasholi is Ishmael Karasholi's nephew. We reached him in Toronto.
Marcus, how did you find out that your uncle had died?
Unfortunately, it was through a post that his daughter has posted.
Do you know anything about how he died, Marcus?
So based on the progression, we had one phone call a few months ago. It was really devastating. It was Lena basically sobbing and crying.
Lena is your 25-year-old cousin.
That's
your uncle's,
correct. Ishmael's
daughter.
Lena was basically on the phone. It was really hard to hear her. She was in a devastated state. She was sobbing and like saying that they've honestly don't have anything to eat. They're surviving off of a date for like the day, and then they're just drinking, she called it sewage water, but unsanitary water, because there's just no infrastructure left in Gaza. They are in the north, mm-hmm. So it's been very, very difficult.
Your family applied to bring your uncle and your cousin to Canada through this new program that was supposed to allow 1,000 people in. What was the Canadian government asking of your uncle in order to get approval?
First is the intent, showing intent that you have family and you'd like to apply. The second step is you receive the code and you provide all of their information. The third step is the biometrics test. And upon that, there's an approval that's received.
And what does that biometrics test require?
So the biometrics, they basically needed to kind of provide fingerprints and provide other data and information, and they cannot do it in Gaza. They were asked to leave Gaza to be able to do that test, so their temporary visa would be approved. And like, it's a convoluted situation, because if they can get out of Gaza into safety anywhere, they would be willing to do that, right? Like, it made no sense at all. It just seemed like an impossible situation, where it's like you're asking them to leave Gaza to do the test so they can get refugee or a temporary refuge in Canada.
Immigration Minister Mark Miller said just earlier this week that he is frustrated with the situation and that he's been pleading with Egypt and Israel to let people cross into Egypt to complete the screening process that's required. What would you like to say if you were speaking directly to Minister Miller or other representatives of the Canadian government about this visa program?
I truly believe there needs to be some sort of a reform. I understand that Australia has provided like 2,000 visas. Like, even if the biometrics is such an important process, and I agree, and I don't have the legal expertise or background in terms of, but these people are not looking to like a leisure trip to Canada. They're not applying for a temporary visa because they're applying for a temporary refuge, a place of safety. And so even if like they have multiple options, like if Canada just accepts them and leaves them in a designated zone where they can get in, get out, they proceed with all the biometrics, they proceed with all of the interviews and the information that they required, and then decide to grant them or not. Like, they're not people that are just like, they're coming to visit Canada, they're seeking refuge.
What do you think Canada can do, Marcus, if it is at that stage in the hands of Egypt and Israel?
With all honesty, I know there has been people have been able to get out. I think if Canada just provides the name at the border at Rafah that these people are applying for refuge and they need to be screened, that there might be a process. Like, there has been a lot of corruption and like a lot of people like charging high fees for people to try to exit the Rafah border, but it's just I don't understand the disconnect. Like, there's literally life and death situation, and we're just trying to figure out the logistics between borders of each countries. And yeah,
when you were able to speak with him and get through, what did your uncle tell you about the possibility that he and Lena could come to Canada?
I'm just gonna have a minute to gather myself. It's a week before he died, we kind of spoke together, and they were talking about the option of like the whole coming to Canada, and maybe Lena can finish her schooling, and mom has started like the whole setting up his room, and they're coming with nothing, right? So she was like trying to see what in my dad's closet that might work for him. And at the end of it all, it's like it's all for nothing. He just passed from something that's so preventable. Just if he had the right food or the right...
I'm so sorry, just, Marcus.
Thank you. I can't believe that this is happening in this day and age, that like countries are not able to intervene or try to save human lives. Like, like the main things, it's just like food, water, shelter. Like those are just the humane things to kind of just, I don't understand it.
What will Lena do now?
That's the more devastating part, because she has no living family members in Gaza anymore. She's like, we don't even know how her living situation is. It sounds like she's with certain people sometimes, and then they're moving to somewhere else and it's different people that she's with. Like there isn't even that stability. Now that he has passed, the lawyer has submitted a humanitarian, like I'm not sure the legality or the forms, mm-hmm. to just kind of still consider Lena's application, but she's a distant relative at this point, because to my mother, it's her niece, and to me, it's my cousin. So they don't even qualify under like the requirements and the restrictions associated with this application have been so frustrating.
How is your mother holding up?
She's been pretty devastated. She still thinks, like, you know, it just, you're looking at a worse situation and you're trying to just compare it to an even worse situation. She's grateful he didn't end up losing a limb, and of course there's no anesthesia or medical care. Yeah, so just mom has been keeping up and just being like, at least he died like in his sleep. He didn't lose a limb. He didn't like get bombed, and part of the casualties and the horror stories that we hear. But it's not that, like, we still don't know what Lena's fate is, and she's like, it's hard to get a hold of her. There's no reliable connection whatsoever. Just been a nightmare.
I hope you get word from her soon, Marcus. I appreciate your time and our condolences again.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
You as well.
We reached Marcus Caraccioli in Toronto. We contacted Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Canada, but we did not hear back by airtime.
The Oscar goes to The Last Repair Shop.
It's The Moment, The Last Repair Shop won this year's Academy Award for Best Documentary Short. It was a celebration of the filmmakers who made the movie about a unique school workshop in Los Angeles that offers free instruments and repairs to students. But it was also a celebration of those students and the small team of repair people who keep music in their lives. Here's one of the co-directors, Chris Bowers, on the Oscar podium.
Last Repair Shop is about the heroes in our schools who often go unsung, unthanked, and unseen. Tonight, you are sung, you are thanked, and you are seen. Thank you all so much for what you do.
Since that Oscar win 10 days ago, more and more people have been watching the film and donating to the underfunded repair shop. Steve Bagmanian is the instrument repair supervisor. We reached him in Los Angeles.
Steve, you and your colleagues were sitting in the balcony at the Oscars ceremony while the rest of us watched on TV. What was it like to hear Chris Bowers say that to you? You are sung, you are thanked, you are seen.
Well, it's hard to explain the feeling, really, yeah. But it was kind of like finally we get recognized. What I meant by that, it's for all these years, from 1959, the shop was, you know, serving LA Unified students and never being recognized on this level. So this was very different, amazing, and just that, to be honest with you, a little bit of goosebumps too.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it a fun time? Did you have a good time at the ceremony?
Oh, yeah. It was very nice. We went to a couple of course parties and stuff. And it was great. It was just a great experience. That personally, I never thought of that I would have something like that in my life. But see how life is.
Yeah, full of surprises. And your story, all of the stories are so wonderful and powerful. Yours in particular, I found very touching as I watched the film several months ago. Are you in the workshop right now?
I'm in my office. Yes.
Okay.
For the shop. Yes.
What are they working on right now?
Well, everyone's working on his stuff. We have Dwayne working on his saxophone, and Patty's working on the French horn. and piano guys at the piano shop, and we're doing this stuff here at the office as usual.
Yeah.
Answering phones, emails, donations, and
talking to people like me as you become more and more famous, and the donations, as you've mentioned, thousands of dollars coming in for the shop. I think there's a broader $15 million fundraising effort, but this is a pretty good start. How is the money going to be spent?
Money is going to be spent for the wellness of the shop. Mm-hmm. We need to upgrade the shop tool-wise, and of course, maybe purchase another bigger ultrasonic washing machine that actually washes the instruments. Some merchandise for the shop, and of course, for music education, hiring more technicians. That's the main thing. And I would like to have apprenticeship programs. Maybe some high school kids would be interested mm-hmm. in learning the trade.
Be able to repair more instruments and
yes.
get students to learn what's going on as well. I wonder what it's like for you to see the shift, because you've worked there for more than two decades now, and you've certainly, it hasn't been money rolling in over those two decades. You've seen cutbacks, you've lost staff, you've seen resources dwindle. What was that like on the other end of the spectrum to watch it? And I guess it would feel like it's slipping away.
You know, after all these cuts we had, 2009 was a big cut, and then we had some furloughs, and of course people are retiring. So in 2013, shop was down to six people. Mm. And when I started here in 2003, it was 28 people. So, I mean, you can see the difference. And now, since we have twice as much instruments, and more schools, of course, more students, this is so important. This documentary, it's a breath of fresh air for the shop, for everyone, pretty much, and it just completely turned everything around. And I'm so very glad to see that and very glad to be part of it.
Yeah, it's impossible not to smile and get goosebumps here in the studio, too, hearing you talk about it and the possibilities. Had you met the children, the students whose instruments have been repaired in your shop before, who are featured in the documentary, before you went to the Oscars together? I wonder what that was like to meet them and chat with them.
Well, I met him at the, I think, first or second screening we had in one of our high schools. And actually meeting the kids in the high schools were totally different experience. We never had that before. We never interact with students. Our job was just to work on instruments and repair them. But this time, when actually students, too, saw what shop is all about after they watched the documentary,
yeah.
You should have seen their faces and the questions they were asking. It was just amazing experience. You could see their faces come alive.
That must
it
be rewarding great. For you to see.
It was
see that.
very rewarding. And it was, I felt very proud. I always did. But when I met students, it's a different way of feeling proud. It's mm-hmm. it's like you actually see who you're doing it for. Today we received another maybe 40 or 50 thank you notes from one of the high schools, from kids. And last week we received a couple of packages of thank you notes, handwritten notes. This is our Oscars right there. Every note is our Oscar. Mm-hmm. Every thank you email from a teacher, that's our Oscar.
Oh,
yeah, so.
That's lovely, Steve. You were making some plans to retire, Steve, as I understand it. What's the plan now?
You know, for almost 22 years, I was planning to retire. My birthday, March 5th, 2024.
Well, happy belated birthday.
Yeah, thank you. And, of course, now I can't retire now since
okay.
I have a plan at least bring shop partially, at least partially, back to its capacity where it was, hire more people. So if I can accomplish that while I'm here, if I can take advantage of all this good publicity, thank God, that we have right now. So if I can do this and then retire with peace, so I can pass the shop on, so they won't have as many problems that we had back in 2013 when we inherited the shop. Retirement can wait. You know, I'm taking one day at a time. We'll see how it goes.
Understood. Steve, a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and God bless you all.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Steve Bagmanian is the head of the Los Angeles Unified School District Instrument Repair Shop. He's in Los Angeles.
Our love affair with that film continues. You can hear our chat with co-director and Canadian Ben Proudfoot and find a link to the short doc at cbc.ca/AIH.
As concessions go, it was pretty standard stuff. Tonight did not go as we had hoped, Ohio Republican candidate Derek Myers said, but I'm looking forward to uniting behind the congressman-elect and working with him to get President Trump re-elected to the White House and evicting Joe Biden. Like I said, pretty standard, and yet Mr. Myers shocked the world with his concession because he boldly issued it yesterday afternoon, more than 4 hours before the polls even closed. This certainly was an aggressive tactic, and his opponents in the crowded race to become the Republican candidate in Ohio's 2nd congressional district must have been caught off guard. Was it some Machiavellian stratagem, some gambit pulled from the art of war? No. 10 minutes later, his campaign sent a message reading, "Disregard concession email," followed half an hour later by a note from Derek Myers himself entitled, "So you want to know what happened, eh?" The concession email was sent in error as it was being loaded into the media distribution portal as a draft in the event of a loss. Accidentally, the Send Now button we clicked instead of draft. Syntactically weird, but otherwise makes sense. As he added, it's not uncommon for campaigns to prepare speeches for a win and a loss, quote, especially on such an impotent night, unquote. Unfortunately, in his haste, he typed impotent instead of important. Still, total reset. The race was back on until the votes were in. In elections, there is inevitably a winner and those who go on to fight another day, Mr. Myers said in his second and final concession message of the day, after he came 11th out of 11 candidates. I don't view this outcome as a defeat. Rather, it's an enriching experience for which I am genuinely grateful. Well, that's good to hear. But it sounds like yesterday alone was enriching in the sense that concession is good for the soul.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly says Canada will stop sending arms to Israel. That announcement follows Monday's passage of an amended NDP motion that called on the government to, quote, cease the further authorization and transfer of arms exports to Israel to ensure compliance with Canada's arms export regime, unquote. And Israel's Foreign Affairs Minister has condemned Canada for it. But Global Affairs had already announced the temporary suspension of permits for military exports to Israel on January 8th. And officials claim only non-lethal exports have been permitted since October 7th. So it's not clear what exactly is being paused and what may still be ongoing. That's the kind of thing Kelsey Gallagher has been struggling to make sense of since well before the current war. He's with the Canadian Peace Research Institute Project Plowshares, and we reached him in Hamilton, Ontario.
Kelsey, your organization recently reported Canada has authorized nearly $30 million in military exports to Israel since October 7th. Give our listeners a sense of what that figure includes. What are they sending?
Absolutely. So documents released through Canada's Access to Information System showed that most of these goods were categorized as applying to things like aerospace goods for military end use, as well as bombs, missiles, and associated components. So it's somewhat of a potpourri of goods that were authorized, but these were all military end-use goods.
A lot of this hinges on the terminology we've heard from the government, lethal versus non-lethal. Global Affairs, as you likely know, says there are no open permits for exports of lethal goods to Israel. What is the government saying when they say non-lethal military aid? What are they trying to describe there?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that's been posed before. The distinction between lethal and non-lethal military goods is not a standing categorization. So when we hear the distinction between lethal and non-lethal goods, what we hear from the government is actually a distinction between likely full systems as compared to parts and components. So mm-hmm. full systems would be things like tanks or combat aircraft and so forth, with non-lethal goods being parts and components that comprise those full systems.
Earlier in your initial answer, you listed bombs as part of that $30 million figure. You're saying, though, components that could be used in bombs are part of that figure, just to clarify?
That's our understanding. However, due to long-standing lack of transparency in how Canada reports these arms exports, it's difficult to tell. We do know that these are pieces of technology that are for end use in bombs and components, but we don't get a very good idea of exactly what pieces of equipment they're being used in, or exactly who the end user is, aside from those exports being destined for Israel.
We have heard, you know, in the context of the war in Ukraine, when Canada makes an announcement of what it's going to send to try to help Ukrainian forces, they give a pretty comprehensive list. What is behind a lack of transparency in this context, do you think?
Again, it's a good question. I think that Canada's reporting of its military aid to Ukraine is actually a high watermark for transparency. We've seen the Department of National Defense be quite forward and quite descriptive and quite technical with the type of equipment it's supplied to Ukraine since February 2022. However, as you know, we don't see that level of transparency afforded to Canada's military exports to Israel. I don't think that it'd be unusual to say that this is a controversial topic, and supplying military goods to Israel, particularly as those military goods do face a substantial risk of being used in human rights violations, considering Israel's conduct since October 7th. It's controversial for the government of Canada to be upfront about this. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be, and it doesn't mean that they can't.
When you say the word controversial, certainly the NDP motion that passed this week with considerable Liberal amendments, as we've been reporting on, that was controversial as well. There are many people, including Liberals, who voted against it, who say that was the wrong decision, and feel that move was controversial.
Yeah, I could see that, and absolutely, you know, I've read that myself. However, this being a controversial topic does not obviate Canadian officials from having to comply with binding obligations not to export weapon systems when there are serious human rights considerations. Canadian officials do face obligations under both the UN Arms Trade Treaty as well as domestic law to not export weapon systems if there's a substantial risk they could be used in serious violations of human rights, and absolutely those risks are evident. That threshold has absolutely been crossed. So whether or not this is controversial, Canadian officials do have to observe their binding obligations under Canada's arms control regime.
When Minister Joly says they are going to make good on that motion that was passed on Monday, but given what we've already heard about what's already happening, what actually is changing in this scenario?
So from our understanding, the new policy, as it's actually being reported within the last couple hours, will apply to new export permits for arms transfers to Israel. While this on its face is a good amendment to Canadian policy, it doesn't go as far as the motion called for. So the motion actually called for Canada to cease the further authorization of arms exports to Israel, but to also cease those that have already been approved by Canadian officials. From our understanding, this policy would allow those transfers to go forward.
What would you need to hear from Minister Joly or Global Affairs to reassure you that Canada is meeting its commitments under international law?
Well, we need to see a full cessation of arms transfers into scenarios where there's a risk that they could be used in human rights violations, right? So this would, again, apply to those permits that have already been approved and those permits that could be approved down the road. We've seen the government of Canada take principled stances on this before, again, to refer back to Ukraine in the opening days following Russia's full-scale invasion. Global Affairs Canada revoked existing permits and refused to issue new ones, considering the very real risk that these weapon systems could be used by the Russian Federation. From our perspective and from the perspective of other Canadian human rights organizations, the same policy should be implemented.
Those who oppose this motion that passed this week say that this is taking away Israel's ability to defend itself, though.
Sure, and I don't think that anyone is calling into question Israel's right to defend itself, but it does not have the right to defend itself in the way in which it has. Canada should only be approving arms exports to those countries where we can be certain that they're not going to be used in human rights violations.
Kelsey, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kelsey Gallagher is a researcher with Project Plowshares. We reached him in Hamilton, Ontario. And we contacted Global Affairs Canada for a comment on this story, but we didn't hear back before airtime. Next month, Montreal's Pizzeria Napoletana will launch a new kind of pizza. It will be great, due to being pizza. But it's not just the ingredients or preparation that will make it noteworthy. It's where that pizza is being delivered. Because after the launch of the pizza in the restaurant, a slice of it will be launched into space as part of Space Concordia's Star Sailor project. Linda Girolamo and her family own Pizzeria Napoletana. We reached her in Montreal.
Linda, was this always a dream for you to send a pizza from your restaurant to space?
No, but I never dreamed of it. So I can't say dreams come true, but it's a beautiful experience.
What do you think your dad would have thought? I mean, he took over this pizzeria more than 40 years ago. Was it a dream for him?
Excited.
He's
so excited because he says, I saw you on TV.
He's excited just about you being on TV. Forget the pizza going to space.
Yes.
So how did this idea come together?
Well, George, the student from
this
Concordia
is George
University.
Defoe.
Yeah, George Defoe. Along with the rest of the team of the rocketry division of Concordia University. I know him very well. He's since he was a small kid. He went to school with my son, and he worked at the pizzeria many summers while he was in school. And he came up this summer, and I knew that he was building rockets, and they had launched already one in the past. And, you know, every time they launch one, it doesn't come back, so they have to build another one and do more research. So they needed funding. And I said, you know, George, I could help you. And it just started like that. And then I said, why don't we just, like, launch a pizza with the rocket into space? And he's like, wow. He goes, okay, I never thought about that. He goes, well, maybe not a pizza, but we could do a slice.
But you said, I want to send the whole pizza.
Yeah, I said, I like the whole pizza. Well, he goes, you know, there's aerodynamics and there's a lot of things to evaluate before that. He goes, but we could do a slice. And that's how it all started.
And you decided that you couldn't send just anything off the menu. You had to top yourself even. What did you create?
Well, I wanted to create something that represents, first of all, the world, because now we're going to space. Mm-hmm. And I wanted also something to represent Italy, obviously. So I created a recipe. I wanted a dry ingredient because, you know, you always see, maybe because I watch too much TV and movies, but there's always like dry ingredients that they bring into space for snacks and stuff. So I said, I want a dry ingredient. Then I want a vegetable. There will be potatoes on this pizza because potatoes are all over the world. The whole world eats potatoes, grows and eats potatoes. So I said, I'm going to put the potato. Okay. And then I said, what else can we add? So we're adding Italian sausage. And for the dry ingredient, I also wanted a smoky flavor, but I didn't want something artificial. So what I decided is that we're going to put iscrocchi. Iscrocchi is a dried, undried red pepper that's then fried and jarred. It's a iscrocchi is a red pepper that comes from Italy. The one we're using is from Matera. And it was important for me also because Matera is one of the most ancient town in Italy. If you go visit it, it's in Basilicata, south of Italy. It's like a stopped in time. So it was important for me to create a recipe that had a meaning, that truthful meaning.
The past and the future, all packed past, into that slice.
Yes.
What's the pizza called?
Rocket Pizza.
Oh, well, obviously. How did I should have known.
I wanted to use another name, but I was thinking about the Luna, Stella.
Right.
But then I said, you know, let's just, for this one, it's going to be the Rocket Pizza. It's going to be available only for a month. We're going to do a limited edition. Then we might create another one once we launch.
Yeah. You got a whole business and rollout plan going, Linda. You don't mess around. You think that there's more launches to come.
Well, in August, they're gonna light up their reactors and see how everything is going. If they have positive results, then they should be able to launch by the end of the year.
Okay.
And it's gonna be a first launch. It's gonna be on Canadian soil. Not sure if maybe Nova Scotia, and it's going to be the first time they will launch this kind of rocket, and that this kind of rocket been built here in Canada by these Concordia students.
Are you going to be at the launch, or are you going to have a party at the pizzeria?
Oh, I'm doing everything. I'm doing both.
I like the way you think. But you know, I mean, you know that pizza has gone into space in the past. Not from your pizzeria, a little place called Pizza Hut you may have heard of. This went back to the ISS in 2001. Did you know this? Yeah, Pizza Hut did this. Do you have...
And maybe they did like the kind of thing that they, for the astronauts to eat it there?
Yeah, a Russian cosmonaut ate that pizza.
Okay. Yeah. No, us were launching it with a rocket.
No one's going to eat it up there.
Nobody. Maybe.
Oh.
We know.
Linda, look at you.
Are there aliens? Is somebody going to find that slice?
Marketing
and
genius.
And decide to come down to Earth and eat the whole pizza? I don't know.
So much to watch for, Linda. I think we're going to talk again. Linda, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Linda Girolamo and her family-owned Pizzeria Napoletana. We reached her in Montreal. The Olympic Games pit athletes from around the world against each other, testing the limits of human skill, endurance, and determination. But it's not just about competition. It's also about bringing people together in more ways than one. In advance of this summer's games, Olympic organizers in Paris have begun to show off parts of the new Olympic Village. When the athletes arrive there this summer, they will have a place to eat and a temporary home, where they'll rest on sustainable bed frames made of cardboard. And according to Laurent Michaud, the director of the Olympic and Paralympic Village, they'll also have somewhere to connect with each other, like-minded athletes. Here's how he put it to Sky News.
We wanted to create some places where the athletes will feel very enthusiastic and comfortable, so they can have some conversations, discussions, and to share their core values about sports. So we have made a village club also, with a lounge, with a sports bar, no alcohol, of course, over there. But it's going to be a great place, so they can actually share their moment and their environment here.
A club where enthusiastic athletes can come together to share their moment, like a heartwarming sports movie. And it seemed like a PG sports movie until Mr. Michaud announced other preparations for the 9,000 athletes expected to stay in the village.
We are aiming to have 300,000 condoms here at disposal for the athletes in the village. It's a quantity that makes sure that everybody will have what they're expecting and what they need.
Okay, that's a lot, but I guess it really will be a true test of the athletes' endurance, not to mention the endurance of their cardboard beds. When Rwandans head to the polls this summer, they will choose a president, but they won't have much choice. Last week, the country's high court declined to allow a leading opposition figure to run against Paul Kagame. His critics say that will ensure another victory for the man who's been president of Rwanda since 2000. Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza is the leader of Rwanda's Development and Liberty for All movement. We reached her in Kigali.
Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza, you wrote in the aftermath of the court's decision that you were profoundly disappointed. Were you surprised?
Yes, I was surprised that a judge can make this kind of mistake. With my lawyers, we're looking how we can make an appeal.
Why do you think the court made this decision?
You know, the judge in Rwanda are not independent. In Rwanda, we have one institution that with the powerful, that is the presidential office. This is the other institution are not free. They are not. They don't have the power to take a decision. Or so that is really the problem we have in our country.
The court, as you know, continues to insist it is independent, though.
No, there's no independent. The court is not independent. Yeah, this luring showed that there is no change for a genuine opposition in Rwanda. This the political space remains restricted to those who do not to the line of the government.
If we go back in time, I was reading an essay that you wrote about when you first wanted to run for president back in 2010. You talk about leaving your family, saying, you know, you'd likely be back soon. What happened?
When I come back from the exile in the Netherlands in 2010 and ran as presidential candidate later that year, a few months later, I was arrested and involved into political motivated judicial process. So this, I hoped to go back to visit my family, but since then, I have not seen my husband, and my husband is very sick since 2016. He cannot travel to visit me. So I asked the Rwanda government the authorization to visit him, but I did not receive any answer.
You also spent 8 years in prison. Five of them were in solitary confinement. You've talked about not being able to see your family. You know, you can't leave the country. You can't participate in the political process as you want to. What keeps you going and keeps you committed to trying to make change in your country?
You know, I have strived to be the voice for all victims of the oral dark history in our country. I am engaged for a reconciled and democratic and prosperous Rwanda, based on the fundamental values of democracy, the rule of law, good governance, and the equal opportunities. This is all values that I am striving to achieve in our country. So I have pain that I can't see visit my husband who is very sick. I have pain that I can't to be next to my kids, my great kids, but I have to struggle to achieve those fundamental values in our country.
What do you think it will take to develop the kind of thriving democracy you want to see in Rwanda?
It is difficult to say. It's very see that until today, after 13 years, that the RPF, the ruling party, is in power and they refuse to open up the political space. I think it will take long times, but I am ready to go ahead and decide until we achieve this.
Others are fighting alongside you. What has happened to them as they continue their fight?
Yeah, that is a big problem we have in Rwanda. For example, the vice president for my prior political parties was kidnapped when he was in prison. And until today, the institution in charge of prisoners in Rwanda, they cannot explain what happened the day he was disappeared. And my assistant was assassinated, and our representative in the eastern of our country was also kidnapped. And 4 months later, the coordinator for my political party was assassinated. So this is the kind of the actions that happen against the members of opposition. And many times I asked the Rwanda authorities, why the assassination and the kidnapping happen only to the members of the opposition?
And what
until
do they
today,
say?
I have no. I don't have any response on those questions.
Are you worried about being kidnapped or imprisoned again?
Yes, I know that everything can happen at every moment, but I decide not to live in fear. I have to go with my struggle, to go ahead with my struggle until we achieve our goal.
Victoire, I thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you too.
Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza as the leader of Rwanda's Development and Liberty for All movement. We reached her in Kigali. With a population of just 3.3 million people and an area of some 1.5 million square kilometers, Mongolia is the world's most sparsely populated sovereign state. And right now, vast swaths of its largely empty land are littered with the carcasses of dead livestock. The fatalities follow months of extreme cold. They're a symptom of a weather phenomenon that's known locally as the Dzud. It's not totally uncommon in the nation's herding communities. After all, they have a word for it. But it is becoming more common. And a new appeal from the International Federation of the Red Cross says this year's Dzud has already claimed the lives of 4.7 million animals. Olga Jumaiva is the head of the IFRC's East Asia delegation. She just returned from a trip to eastern Mongolia. We reached her in Beijing.
Olga, what did you see when you were there? What kind of devastation has this Dzud brought with it?
Well, indeed, Neil, I saw a crisis that has gripped Mongolia, and it's the land, it's a beautiful land of the clear blue skies. But since November last year, Mongolia has been locked in a battle against the harshest winter it has seen in nearly half a century. So, for example, throughout the whole of last week, we have been driving for over 2,000 kilometers, visiting some of the most affected provinces in the east. And along this whole journey, we were confronted with heart-wrenching scenes, piles of dead animals scattered across the snowy and icy steppes. And every day, the herders who we met, they witnessed the loss of their animals. And their homes are marked by some somber spots where the carcasses of their animals lay.
I suspect it puts so much pressure on them as they try to prioritize, you know, taking care of that livestock that's not just animals to them, as you've said, but also trying to sustain themselves.
Indeed. And the many stories that were shared with us by all these, I have to say, very resilient people, they paint a very, very grim picture. And when we were driving to the homes of people, often it's a very long and slippery road. They are at least 60 kilometers or more from the district center. And as you can imagine, the price of fuel is now rising and people's income is diminishing. And what they do, they compromise on fuel. So they cannot drive, and therefore they cannot access health facilities. They cannot go to the market to buy some basic necessities, even food. And again, we heard so many stories that this winter or the last couple of months, many herders lost at least 10 kg of their weight because they're out there herding their livestock, trying to desperately find pastures where they can graze. So they compromise on some basic items. But amidst that despair, we also witnessed something really remarkable, and that was the unwavering hope and resilience of these families. And they do face the winter's wrath with incredible strength, refusing to succumb to despair. So they are the embodiment of the human spirit. They have determination to persevere. They were smiling. They were joking. They were welcoming us. They were giving us tea and were even offering food, even though they were suffering through the shortages of foods.
Did it surprise you?
It touched me. It touched me deeply. And probably it did surprise me because within that, people were also saying that they're shocked. They don't know what to do. They don't know what is going to happen to them. But at the same time, they were expressing a lot of hope and they were smiling and they were laughing. And that really surprised me.
And what about children there?
The herder, as I say, they live quite far away. Children would go to school and they'd stay in the dormitories in the school. And because they... violence is on the rise in the families because the relations are becoming very tense, because adults cannot really cope with the devastation, children refuse to go home.
It's a crisis on so many levels, with so many layers. You didn't just visit with the families there to try to assess the situation. You were also trying to provide help. What were you able to provide?
The Mongolian Red Cross, they're tirelessly working to provide help to people, and they cover the entire country. So they have already reached 5,000 vulnerable households. They gave them aid, they gave them cash, they gave them animal care kits, they provide psychosocial support. And so with the IFRC allocated 500,000 Swiss francs to support 1,900 households when the animal death rate started to increase disproportionately in mid-February. But now we see that the scale of this crisis worsens. We launched the emergency appeal seeking 4.5 million Swiss francs to support 10,000 herder families affected by Zud.
And are they preparing for the Zud to come again?
Yeah, Zud is becoming a regular occurrence, but this year is much more dramatic. And the amount of snow, the extremely cold temperatures this year, they froze the land completely. So it's impossible for animals to graze through the thickness of the ice. but indeed we need to be preparing for Zoot, and currently we're responding. But what we need and what we're also working on is to find ways to reduce people's vulnerabilities and build up their resilience capacity so that we do not respond to Zoot, but we stand prepared and we avoid unnecessary deaths of livestock and unnecessary vulnerability and slipping down to poverty.
Olga, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil.
Olga Jumaeva is the head of the East Asia delegation of the International Federation of the Red Cross. We reached her in Beijing. It can be easy to beat yourself up about an overdue library book, but however late you've left things, rest assured there are worse offenders out there. Take the copy of Stephen Leacock's Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town that was borrowed during the First World War and found its way back to the Greater Victoria Public Library in 2018. Or the person who returned an elementary treatise on electricity to a Massachusetts library 119 years past its 1904 due date. Or Benson Lossing's History of the United States, which was signed out in 1927 and returned to a Napa Valley library last year. It's not every day that an entire century of human history goes by in the time it takes a person to read about the preceding ones. So, sure. The person who returned a book to a Colorado library after a mere 37 years may not be feeling too groovy, but they shouldn't let this experience harsh their mellow. The book this person was reading for nearly four decades was entitled Psychedelics, The Uses and Implications of Hallucinogenic Drugs. It was due back in 1987, and it was returned with a note reading, quote, "Sorry so late, it's been a long, strange trip," unquote. In a Facebook post acknowledging its return, the High Plains Library District wrote, quote, "Far be it from us to suggest that a book on psychedelics may have affected someone's perception of time," unquote. Points for humor all around, but when it comes to punctuality, there's room for improvement. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.